So I'm going to speak for about 45 minutes. I realize now I'm going to be doing something quite difficult because I actually plan to be typing various things that I say, but I'm going to be holding this at the same time. let me just let's see. Okay, I want to increase the font. Yes. Okay. Is this? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Can you hear me? Can you hear? You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Okay. Well, so we have an issue on the table here. I want to thank Enrique and Melissa especially for this opportunity. And this is a very important issue about the epistemology of how we understand the environment. And I'm talking to you about this from the standpoint of social epistemology. And I think it's already been indicated to you that this is sort of the field that I'm known for. And the reason why we have a field of social epistemology to begin with is because, you might say, starting in the 19th century, there was this distinction that was made between philosophy and sociology with regard to how knowledge, the production and distribution of knowledge, should be studied. And epistemology, generally speaking, especially if we move into the 20th century, has been primarily concerned with how the individual mind encounters the world. And sociology, generally speaking, has been concerned with social organization, and of course knowledge is implied in that, but generally speaking, the knowledge aspect of social organization hasn't been foregrounded very much. And so social epistemology, in a way, is trying to bring these things together. And so I've been doing this now for the last 25 years. There's others who've been doing it as well. And I think from the standpoint of talking about the environment, you know, if we think of it as a current policy issue, I think there's an interesting distinction that we might want to begin with here. Sorry. There are two different ways in which one might think about the social character of knowledge. And this is a distinction that I have made a big deal about in a relatively recent book of mine, but I think, in fact, it maps, for those of you who are familiar with philosophy, the distinction between analytic and continental philosophy. Okay, so the difference between the way in which philosophy, and including epistemology, is done in the Anglo-American world, which is analytic philosophy, versus how it's done in continental Europe. Generally speaking, these two traditions have two quite different ways of thinking about the social character of knowledge. And the common sense tradition I associate with the Anglo-American tradition, and the collective memory approach I associate with the continental tradition. And one way one might think about the difference between these two ways of thinking about social knowledge is in terms of how they deal with the problem of induction. And induction is a very kind of, you might say, philosophy 101 style problem about epistemology, which generally speaking has to do with just because things have been as they have been in the past and we know about them, why should we think they're going to be like this in the future? Okay, and so the problem of induction is, how do you make the inference from the past to the future? Now, there are two fundamentally different attitudes one can have to this problem. And a lot has to do with the fact that in practice, induction largely succeeds. right? That is to say, if we imagine the future is going to be very much like the past has been, then usually we're right. And so in that respect, induction is regarded as a very robust form of knowledge. Now, this way of thinking about things is very much wedded to the analytic tradition. Okay? And the reason why somebody, for example, like David Hume, is seen as an important person in the analytic tradition is because he wonders whether there is anything more to this idea of success, right? That the past is always like the future, and so if we bet on the future being like the past, we're likely to succeed, right? Whether there's anything more to it than just sheer repetition. Is there anything intellectually interesting about the fact that the future tends to be like the past? Right? And Hume opens this question up and asks, on what basis do we believe this? Right? Because if it's intellectually interesting, then we should have some kind of causal analysis, some kind of deep structural understanding of why it is that the future is always likely to be like the past. And Hume's point is that, as a matter of fact, we don't have such an account. And so the fact, this is not to say we shouldn't believe the future will be like the past, but whatever reasons they are not, strictly speaking, epistemological. There are other kinds of things going on. And so Hume has been, in fact, very helpful in promoting a certain kind of view of knowledge where you talk about knowledge as a survival value, right? In other words, beliefs that have lasted a long time and have enabled several generations of people to reproduce themselves in a given environment, right? That is knowledge in a very robust empirical sense. And it is one that comports very well, let's say, with Darwin's theory of evolution, where, in a sense, how do you know if a species knows what it's doing? Well, it stays alive long enough to reproduce for a next generation. And so from that standpoint, the whole idea that induction is a successful form of knowledge carries over into the biological realm, which is to say, into the kind of realm that people here, I assume, would be most concerned about. So it's not by accident that something like induction is seen as important. But that's not the only way of thinking about induction. One may think about induction in a rather different way, and I think this is very much in the tradition of the continent. And here I want to raise a term that is often very very controversial, and this is the idea of the dialectic. Okay, and the dialectic as a form of knowledge treats the past rather differently from that of induction as understood in the analytic philosophical tradition. Because basically what the dialectic suggests, if one thinks of a dialectical conception of history, whether we're talking about Hegel or Marx or any of these people, is that the way in which knowledge originates, the way in which we actually come to understand and be able to make sense in the world so that we can succeed, is in fact, the word I would use in English is alloyed. That is to say that it includes things that are in fact true and can be generalizable, but also include other things that in fact hold us back from making progress in the future. Right? So it's an alloy. It has some parts that are correct indefinitely, but other parts that in fact may be true for the circumstance in which we live now and may have been true for the circumstance in which we've lived in the past, but will not take us forward in the future. So there's a sense in which when you think about the dialectic as a basis for knowledge, its attitude toward induction is what you might call, in English, is wheat chaff. Where we have this expression in English, I don't know whether it translates, where you separate the wheat, the valuable part, for the part that's rubbish. Right? And in a sense, the way you make progress is by knowing how to make that difference. Right, so in a sense, you are building on the past, but part of what you're doing when you're building on the past is discarding what was bad about the past. Right, so you carry forward the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. The good stuff is the wheat, the bad stuff is the chaff. Okay, that's the general idea, and I think if you get that idea clearly, then I think you understand what the dialectic is supposed to be about. The dialectic is basically that kind of idea, right, made in a more abstract form. And what is this? What does this alternative conception reflect? Well, it reflects many things. I won't talk about the theological side of this, which has to do with original sin and things like this, because sometimes when one when one talks about Hegel, and one talks about the kind of philosophy he has, one talks about absolutism, right? He's an absolute idealist. Maybe this expression means something, especially if you take a sort of textbook view of the history of philosophy. The sense of absolute is that of absolution of sin. Absolution of sin, right? So in other words, you live a human existence, and there's going to be part of it that you want to leave behind, get rid of, right? Purge yourself of. And then there's other parts you want to take forward and build on to go to someplace better. Right? And that's what absolution is in the theological sense. And that's how you should always think about absolutism as a kind of philosophical position. And I think that in a sense this is kind of the motion we're talking about with regard to thinking about how knowledge from the past and the present has impact on the future. Namely, there is definitely stuff there to build on, but a lot of this stuff is in fact captive, right? It is some restrained by the origins of the knowledge. Right? I mean, if you think about original sin, right, the idea is that in some sense, yes, Adam came to know various things, but under very unfortunate circumstances. And so there's a sense in which some of what he may have learned may be valuable, but in a sense the context in which he learned it was bad. So one has to always be making these kinds of distinctions between what one wants to leave behind and what one wants to take forward. And so it's not by accident, for example, whether we're talking about political revolutions or scientific revolutions, that in fact the way in which knowledge makes progress in the strongest sense is usually by committing at some level, some sort of violence. Right? Where there's a sense in which one has to make a bold move forward, right, which involves taking forward the past, but in a new direction, which often has very, harsh consequences, but then one reflects afterwards what was good that can still be taken forward, and what was bad about it. And you see, one of the problems with science as it is produced today, and it is a problem that is very similar to the way in which religious knowledge was produced in the past, especially in the Christian tradition in the Western world, is institutionalization. Okay, institutionalization is a very important issue to talk about in this context, because in a sense, institutions, so we're talking about science as it is being reproduced in academic disciplines that are being taught in universities generation after generation, right? Obviously, they are the main place where what is good about the past can be taken forward into the future and added to it by the professors who are supposedly doing research that is designed explicitly to advance the frontier. Okay? So institutionalization is not a bad thing in itself. The problem with institutionalization is it carries the past sometimes too much with it. It constitutes a drag, you might say. Okay? And part of this is unavoidable. Namely, in order to see why something is progress, you have to be able to see how it is moved from the past. So you do need to learn about the past. But what you don't need to do is to worship it. Right? And somehow use the past as a standard on which you then judge what future knowledge should be. You see, you need a kind of exercise of wheat and chaff, like I was talking about earlier here. So this is a very important kind of point, which I think to a large extent doesn't get really discussed enough, but has a lot to do with, in fact, the future of knowledge production in areas where we can easily imagine the knowledge involved changing very quickly just because of political circumstances and also empirical research. And, you know, issues having to do with the environment very much fall into that category. And so we have to be, as it were, sensitive as epistemologists to what it is that we want to actually preserve and take forward from the past, and what, in a sense, we want to discard, because the world, in a sense, has substantially changed. This is the challenge for epistemologists, it seems to me, and it has to be done within an institutional framework. And the reason why it has to be done that way, and it's not just a matter for individuals to decide, is because, in a sense, the kinds of decisions that we take about issues as broad as those of the environment are ones that are going to have implications for future generations. So in a sense, this is an attempt to construct the legacy of the future. So we have to be kind of responsible about this. It is not simply a matter of what we happen to believe now about what happens to be going on in the environment, but rather thinking about the terms on which we would want people in the future to think about the environment. Right? Understanding that whatever we believe at this moment may change, but at the same time there are certain fundamental issues that we want to carry forward and not forgotten. Okay? And I do think that this is in a sense the role for the epistemologist to reinforce this kind of understanding in the institutional structure of the university, where academics are responsible for intellectually reproducing the next generation. Okay, so this is kind of where I'm coming from on this. And so far I have been talking about this in a way that doesn't really take a stand on issues about climate change, for example, which may be, I'm not sure about this audience, but maybe an issue that's very important with regard to the epistemology of the environment. But here I think, I mean, let's say we focus on climate change for a moment. And think about this from an epistemological standpoint. The first thing that I would want to do, if I want to really understand this, is get a sense of the history of the discussion. Right? So in other words, get a sense of where did all of the taken for granted understandings come from? How did they manage to get institutionalized? Right? Because in a sense, when you're doing epistemology of this kind of stuff, you want to know something about default epistemic positions. That is to say, what is the taken for granted position at the beginning of the discussion if you want to be considered someone who is rational and credible? What is it? Where do you have to start from? What is it that most people who know something about this matter is taken to believe or agree on? That is the thing. That is why you need to know the history. Even if you end up wanting to reject the history, you've got to know the history, because it's not by accident that we start at a certain viewpoint in discussing these matters. So that's the first point about epistemology that's important. Now, the second point, I think, is where do you want to go with this kind of knowledge, right? What is the point of worrying about climate change? That's a really important point, okay? And so, here I would say, how does something become a problem rather than just a fact? Okay? How does something become a problem rather than just a fact? Because it is true. I mean, there is a long history, and it goes back at least 100 years, and the person that everybody normally cites in this is the Nobel Prize winning Swedish chemist, Svante Arrhenius, who started talking about global warming way back in 1900. Okay? This is not a new idea. What is new, however, is the fact that it's considered a problem. Okay? And that's quite interesting, because there are two issues here that I think from an epistemological standpoint, one always has to be careful about. Right? On the one hand, we do develop knowledge about things, and actually the knowledge at the empirical level, that is to say at the level at which, let's say, temperatures are rising and things of that kind, it gets better and better and we find out more and more about it. I don't think there's much disagreement on that matter. Okay? Where the disagreements begin, and this is where having the long view is useful, is what is the significance of this? And what is it that we're thinking about from the standpoint of policy that we need to do about it? Okay? So, to bring it up to date, Svante Arrhenius is living around 1900. He's putting forward the idea. Carbon dioxide emissions are increasing. He's talking about this. He's a chemist. He knows about all this stuff. Okay? This is already being mentioned in 1900. He's not losing sleep over this. Okay? And so, even if we move into the 1960s, again, you start to get people saying, yes, carbon dioxide emissions are rising, it's interesting, what do you think we ought to be doing about it? Okay. Now, it's in that context that we start making a distinction conceptually between weather and climate. Okay. Now, climate is normally seen as this long-term, large-scale, kind of difficult-to-change thing that has to do with the natural environment as it is, independently of human beings, in the sense that you sort of operate on the assumption that no matter what human beings do, climate triumphs, right? You may be able to adapt to it and so forth, but there is this climate thing here. Whereas weather is a much more occurrent thing. It's something that changes and so forth. And so then the question becomes, if you're noticing that carbon dioxide emissions are rising over a certain number of years, how should you think about this? Should you think about this as a weather issue, which you perhaps could modify, let's say by seeding clouds and doing various kinds of what's now being called we talk about this in quite recent years, geoengineering, right? Where the idea is, yes, there are these problems out there. Yes, the world's temperature is rising. Yes, it could have all kinds of disastrous consequences, especially for people in, underdeveloped places that can't actually shield themselves from these changes. Well, what we need to do is we need to change the weather. And we may need to change the weather on a regular basis. Right? So in other words, that's the way you address the issue. Right? So in other words, you're sort of proactive. You're saying, you're operating on the assumption that we can actually change the world in a substantial way. But the way we will be changing it is, you might say, in a period or moment by moment basis. Okay, that is the idea of weather modification. It started to become, in the 1960s, a way of responding to what was generally acknowledged then as a rise in carbon dioxide emissions. And as you see with geoengineering, this idea is still in the air now. And if you think about it, what is the frame of reference for this kind of view? Well, the frame of reference is, basically, human beings can figure out how the world works. We have done a lot of things to transform the world, to enable more of us to live better lives. And we will be able to do that in the future. But now, in the future, rather than just changing the land, we'll have to be changing the sky. Okay? And so, in a sense, this is part of the idea. And so, you think about the problem in terms of changes in weather, rather than adapting in some kind of long-term inevitable sense to climate. Because climate is a word rhetorically that is about nature in itself. It has its own changes. We can't control it. Okay? And then you get a different scenario, and this is a scenario that is very familiar from the standpoint of well, most of the environmental movement, I would say today, especially the ones that are politically loudest, is that in a sense human beings have to change who they are. And they have to change who they are in all kinds of ways, starting from the idea that it is not possible for people in developing countries to live lives like those in the so-called first world. Right? There's those kinds of changes that need to be made. But also, we may have too many people on the planet. And there's a sense in which, if we are going to adapt successfully to so-called climate change as it's being described, then we have to curtail the number of people who actually live on the planet, because human beings are seen unequivocally as the main source of the problem. Okay? So the point is, when you start to think about this issue not merely as an issue of weather, but as an issue of climate, then you open yourself to much more drastic solutions, consequences of which involve actually downgrading, I would say, this is my own view, the significance of human beings on the planet. Now, downgrading is a very negative way of putting it. Of course, people would say we're talking about re-embedding humans into nature. Re-embedding, right? That we are these natural beings, you know, just marginally different from animals. And so what we're trying to do now is to adapt to a stable ecology that allows the largest number of species to survive. Because in the end, what matters is the flourishing of life rather than the triumph of humans. Okay? And I think this is really kind of where the issue is with regard to what is the point of developing knowledge of the environment in the future. It will be, where are we going with this knowledge? What is the image of humanity as knowledge producers that is underwriting this? Are we talking about, in a sense, coming up with a form of knowledge that in a very broad way is sustainable? And I use this word, I put this word in quotation marks, because any of you who are familiar with the discussions around this know this word is almost meaningless at this point, right? I mean, it means so many things. It's what we would call in the United States, you know, a political football, right? Sustainability can mean anything, okay? So in a sense, the word doesn't really carry much weight, but what it does suggest, right, is a kind of normative limit, right? That is still what it suggests, a normative limit, right? And then the question becomes, how is this normative limit constructed? And in a sense, social epistemology should be directly concerned with that kind of issue, because it relates to what is the point of gaining knowledge of the world. Is it because, in some sense, we're trying to live a life embedded in nature as it presents itself on Earth, so we can have some kind of harmony, equilibrium, maybe even a steady state sense of the economy, in which the optimal number of humans live in peace with the optimal number of species? That is one view. And I would say that a lot of the people who are pushing now for very strong constraints with regard to climate change are of that kind. But that is actually a downgrading of the status of human beings, historically. Okay, because in fact, the whole point of wanting to even be interested in the pursuit of knowledge as something separate from just living, right? Because remember, we're talking about epistemology here, and epistemology is something more than just breathing. Okay, and so what is the value of actually getting a sense of what it is around in the world? It is clearly something more than sheer survival. We wouldn't need epistemology if the thing that we were concerned about human beings, was sheer survival. Okay? Every other species does perfectly well without epistemology. Okay? And they will continue to do so in their normal state. But we, in some sense, think there's some kind of value that comes from understanding how the entire world, with all of its life forms, are organized, and how it behaves, and where it might be going, and we are the creatures who are going to provide that. That is a presupposition of epistemology. And again, that is very much dependent on the theological backdrop about the specialness of human beings in the monotheistic religions. Like it or not, you don't have to be a religious person to hold this view. Nevertheless, there is an issue as to why it is that what human beings think about the world matters so much. Right? And epistemology doesn't make sense unless you believe it does matter. Otherwise, you can have all kinds of alternative life worlds in which you talk about the way in which species interface with their environments given their mental and sensory powers. And you could just do a complete descriptive natural history of that. But as a matter of fact, the way in which humans interact with the world matters more. And the question is, what is the point of that, you see? Now, that's an open question, and I'm not going to give you answers to that. But the point is, in service of answering that question, it becomes very important that the whole climate change issue gets seen as something that is manageable in a way that enables us to make progress in the ways that we have recognized as progress. Okay? Now, I'm not saying this doesn't mean that we can't change our ways, we can't conserve on energy and all that. By no means. But I do think that, in a sense, whatever changes we do need to make need to be plugged into this larger narrative. Now, let me say something a little bit concrete about this. Because in 2010, just outside of London, in a mansion outside of London, there was this thing published that got an enormous amount of publicity, especially in The Economist magazine, called the Hartwell Paper. And this was an issue about how to deal with matters of climate change. And the whole point about this was that the name of the game is adaptation. But adaptation understood in a very proactive way. That is to say that we adapt not in the sense of falling back and having to respond, you know, in a relatively passive manner by diminishing our wants and needs and so forth, but rather by redefining those wants and needs in terms of new energy sources, new media by which they can be communicated and produced. And the part of the So the Hartwell paper was this kind of manifesto put forward by a bunch of social scientists around the world, led by an economist at the London School of Economics. And the idea was that, yes, there is all this change taking place in the world climate scene, but this is an opportunity now to act with efficient energy resources. Right. In other words, to start to radically reconceptualize in a way that was just seen as speculative in the past of how it is that we might be able to maintain the lifestyles that mark us as human and take us farther away from the animal world, but by consuming less natural resources and relying more on more efficient energy sources. And that this should be on the front agenda of industry. And this is where industry takes some kind of social responsibility. So the point here is that the Hartwell paper is speaking into a space where we cannot expect that the state will solve all our problems. Okay? And so there is a sense in which we have to be able to speak into the economic logic of the time. But we can do so without necessarily compromising the overarching values that have distinguished us as human beings from other creatures in the past. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Hartwell paper, I would recommend that you read it before passing judgment on it. It's a very sophisticated document. It's on the web, you can find it. It really gives this more kind of positive expression to the idea of adaptation to the environment. It is really a matter of, you know, The French Enlightenment philosopher Condorcet, who some of you may know about, he's often given credit for the idea that invention No, necessity, excuse me, sorry. Necessity is the mother of invention. Now this idea, I don't know if this idea, if this phrase has any kind of direct meaning in Spanish, but this is an idea that in fact was very much part of the Enlightenment thinking, right? And Condorcet was referring to the fact that there were people who were talking about the idea that, well, what if human population explodes and sort of engulfs the planet? Won't that mean that all the natural resources will disappear and will cause all kinds of problems? And Condorcet's response was the exact opposite. He said, in fact, if you have more brains working on how the world should be organized, the better things will be. And so the necessity that he was talking about was population pressure. Okay? Now, to be sure, Thomas Malthus, who you probably have heard of through Darwin, right? Thomas Malthus, let me just get him here in case you are not familiar with him. Thomas Malthus, this is at the end of the 18th century, put forward the view that is kind of the basis for Darwin's theory of natural selection. That yes, populations always outstrip natural resources, but what happens in the end is that there's natural selection. Right, that nature decides who shall live and who shall die. This comes from Thomas Malthus. It gets generalized across species by Charles Darwin 50 years later. Okay, this was in response to Condorcet, who had a much more positive, progressive attitude. Namely, the fact that human beings are populating the planet means that there are more opportunities for people to think about the issues that arise with regard to resource allocation and so forth, and as a result, a greater likelihood that there will be solutions that will transform us into a new plane where those problems will no longer be problems. Right? So it is, in a way, a celebration of human ingenuity. I think that that is the spirit in which we need to address these kinds of issues of the environment today. This is not to say that one should be climate change deniers or anything of that sort, but nevertheless, one should take a sort of critical attitude where one can separate clearly what the actual empirical data is about climate change from the various theoretical issues being raised and the sort of policy scenarios that are being promoted. Because there's no doubt about it that in this entire debate, regardless of which side you happen to be on, whether you believe, in fact, that we are doomed unless we radically change our ways, or you believe, yes, change is happening, but we can get around it somehow through our ingenuity if we just cooperate in the appropriate fashion. The fact of the matter is that this sort of thing is happening and we do need to act on it. Okay? But that doesn't mean that we need to be the skeptics who, in a sense, operate on the assumption that humanity itself as a project is the problem. And that's one of the things that I worry about in our time today. I'm going to sort of end things here and open it up to discussion. But I do think that this is kind of the context in which, if one wants to think about what the epistemological implications of environmental philosophy is, it is pretty much at that level, where in a sense the sort of issues that make environmental philosophy so popular and so gripping now has a lot to do with issues relating to how we define our humanity. And that goes back to what the point of having epistemology in the first place is, because epistemology is about some sense in which human knowing is being privileged over other forms of knowing. And so then the question is, what is the point of being a human being who knows things differently from the way in which a dog or a rat or a horse or a whale or a dolphin knows? So in a sense, this is where I come from on this topic, and I will stop now and open it up to questions. So thank you for your attention.
So how's this going to work?
Pues no sé.
So what?
Abriríamos para preguntas.
Yeah.